So what my CV doesn't have on it was the fact that I went to one of Britain's elite universities and dropped out because I was so disgusted at a lot of the privilege that was there. And it turned me into somebody who was very acutely aware of inequality and very political. And so what took me to Africa at that point was that Zimbabwe was newly independent, and I saw myself as contributing to some of the efforts of making Zimbabwe a place that was fairer than had been there before. But it really profoundly shaped a lot of what I'm going to speak about today. So what I'm going to speak about today is to try and trace a history of the gender agenda in development. The story that's usually told runs from an apparent disregard of the differential impacts and opportunities of development on women and men, to efforts to try and integrate women better into development, to a focus on changing gender relations and addressing gender inequality, and to girls and women's empowerment. That's the conventional linear narrative, and we teach it from WID to GAD on gender courses. But I want to step back a little bit further and tell a different kind of history. And this is a history that's very partial in both senses. It's very much my own take on a complicated story that others might tell differently. And it's also made up of a lot of different pieces that may not necessarily fit together, because they are pieces that I've worked on in different parts of my life that don't necessarily fit together. And when I tried to put together some of my work into a continuous narrative, I found there were lots of pieces that didn't fit at all. So this is my best attempt to try and do so. And it draws on various areas of my own work. It draws on the work that I've done in African history and on the anthropology of gender, in work on men and masculinities, on sexualities and gender identities, on gender myths and feminist fables, which I've done with Anne Whitehead and Buzz Harrison here, and most recently on empowerment, and on the work of a consortium I've been so excited to be involved in for the last 5 years, of across the world, problematising and studying the word empowerment in relation to development. So what I'm going to do is look at some of the challenges, so the trajectory, how we came to think of gender in development, and some of the challenges to reframe the gender agenda, which I'm going to define here as an agenda for change that's about creating a fairer and more equal world for all genders. So first of all, to set the context, so the gender agenda, which is an agenda concerned with inequality and power, seems to have given way in development to a much more simple narrative, and that's all about investing in girls and women and mitigating the negative effects that boys and men have on girls and women's life chances and well-being. All we hear about in terms of men, as I'll go on to talk about, is men as vectors of HIV and men's violence against women. So we've now got this very simple narrative about what needs to be done. Gender equality is yesterday's buzzword. Gender's abandoned by this government as being too complicated. And now we're talking all about, in development, about investing in women as the new magic bullet in an industry that grasps at solutions that can be applied at a big scale. So women are represented in this narrative as being more industrious than men, but they're hampered with all kinds of obstacles to realising this potential. So we have DFID, the World Bank, and corporate development actors like the Nike Foundation talking about unleashing girls and women's potential and of girls and women as a weapon against poverty. And this, they tell us, is smart economics. So taking this step back and looking back over a century of development, and I take the history of development as we now know it to begin with the European imperial conquest. The development as planned intervention began to take institutional shape in the 19th rather than the 20th century. And in early colonial times, women were the objects of colonial concern and rescue. Colonial officers sought to save women from uncivilized traditional practices, and they used legislation and the establishment of courts and the establishment of policies to try to do this, so ostensibly in support of women's rights. And if we look historically, we see the British doing this, but particularly the French, seeking to save these women, and then later on realising what they'd done to try and recuperate an idea of the family. So we see during the early colonial period an introduction of divorce laws, the regularisation of a court system to which women began to flock to release themselves from unwanted betrothals and unhappy marriages. And I want to give you an example from a court case that I found from 1892 in Badagry in Nigeria, which is of what they called at that time a consideration that has failed. That means a betrothal that has broken down. And it's a very interesting case. It features a great long testimony and great detail written by the court recorder. And this is a case in which a woman had been brought to the white man who'd recently set up shop adjudicating such cases. And she began to cross-examine her husband and then her ex-husband, or the man who was supposed to be her husband, and her father in court. And the case unfolded, and we see this woman saying, "And when you told me you wanted me to go to Lagos, did I not tell you I didn't want to live there? And when you told me that you didn't like my ways, didn't I tell you I would repay the money you had paid for me?" So here's a very empowered woman making use of these courts to free herself. But it's also a story of empowerment from a time that is represented as a time when women were very abject, when they were locked in these patriarchal family relations and didn't have much power. So the gap between that story from 1892 and some of these representations of women in development intrigued me. So if we look at the colonial period and look at the new constraints and opportunities that were established for women during this period, and how Christianity, civilization, and commerce, the three C's of colonialism, shaped those quite contradictory and paradoxical opportunities. So on the one hand, you have this crisis that starts to emerge in the 1920s, 1930s, as women go to court, get themselves out of these marriages, run away from husbands, go to town. Some of them enter sex work, get opportunities to buy their own property, and all kinds of change starts to happen. And there's a growing category of women called spinsters, non-married women, women who don't want to marry. And then you see a shift in the way in which colonialism works from, first of all, trying to save these women and treat these women as if they needed to have rights, and then to move to treat them as objects of colonial welfare, which was then trying to bring women back into order, working together with colonial, the senior men in, under colonial rule, to save the African family and to restore African values. And I'm getting somewhere in terms of where this is going in terms of gender. So what we see happening then, during this period, the unfolding of colonial rule, the deepening of colonial rule in the 30s and 40s and 50s and going into the 50s, is a transposition of European gender norms to the colonies to shape masculinities and femininities, to create male breadwinners and to create good wives and mothers who can look after the male breadwinners and create a more productive base for the economy. So we see women being put to work for development even during this colonial period. But we also see bad women, who are the ones who run away from their husbands, they go to town, and they also get involved in relationships with men, service their social and sexual needs in town. So this good woman, bad woman trope, which comes again and again in development, but also the trope of the lazy man, which Annie has done some wonderful work on, who needs to be dignified, uplifted through work, and the overworked woman, who's in need of civilizing to be able to devote herself to the home, is something that comes through during this period. So the colonial education sought to give training to women to produce proper, decent women who are hygienic, but also to domesticate dissent, where women start to get involved in political mobilization. So there are interesting resonances and differences with some of the things that came up later in development. So to fast forward a little bit, during the 1950s, then we have, you know, the nationalist movements, women get involved in anti-colonial struggles. In post-independence, I'm focusing primarily on Africa, and post-independence Africa, this involvement in struggle did not result in positions in governance. So the very disregard that women had with the colonial regimes were unable to recognise women's role in governance or women's role in the economy. Again, this pattern carries on and is deepened even further in some contexts in post-colonial African contexts, where nationalists pursued highly conservative gender policies. So they compounded the effects of colonial neglect of women's political and economic roles. And women were put to service of the nationalist project. So against that backdrop, we see by the 1970s that there is growing awareness of the negative impact of colonialism on women, this exclusion of women first by the colonial, over the course of the colonial regime, women exclusion of women's economic and political capacities, and over-concern with their role as wives, as mothers, but also of these bad women. But also the neglect post-independence of women's possibilities as well. So we begin to find that there's a discourse being articulated about women in development and the need for the benefits of development to trickle down. Benefits of development are not trickling down, and that there's a need to do more to integrate women into development. And women's education and skills training that could make them more productive and improve their access to the market become, again, a way in which women become enlisted in the development initiative. So against that backdrop of women being incorporated now into a highly unequal development that's been shaped by the production of particular ideas about masculinity, femininity, the family, and relations between women and men. So juxtaposed against, you know, decades through which those social and economic changes, but also policies and interventions, have shaped the possibilities of social and sexual relationships. through into a time where efforts are being made to include women, but on very, very limited terms, nothing, not including women in changing any of these inequalities, but simply allowing them to do craft projects or, you know, to do a little bit of own account income earning. So pretty much like we're seeing today with the women's empowerment agenda to some degree, not actually addressing any of the fundamental changes that need to occur if we are to have something that's more equal and fair, but more to really incorporate women in already existing development. At that point, on Sussex campus at the IDS, there was a conference that was called the Subordination of Women Conference in 1978, where what came together was a growing critique of this women in development approach, a critique that was being framed very much in terms of materialist focus on unequal and unfair gender relations. It was concerned with gender relations rather than women's issues. And it conceived of these relations as the focus for an agenda for change that would address some of these inequalities. So it was critical of what had gone before, and it was articulating a strongly feminist agenda to try and address these inequalities. And the basis for some of this critique was a critique of the biases of welfare economics and ideas about the household, which showed a male breadwinner and misunderstood the nature of relationships within the household. And it showed a total disregard for women's economic contribution. And also, it pointed to the male bias that had been hardwired into state institutions and policies, both of those of developing countries and also of developed countries who were giving aid. So important contributions came to framing this GAD agenda, came from the work of feminist scholars, anthropologists such as Anne Whitehead, Nyla Kabir, some of the other people who have been very foundational in gender and development, and who began to really point up some of these issues around power and resources. So the way that gender came to be represented, so gender began to be used as a word. We weren't talking about women anymore. It was more about gender. And it came to be represented in a departure, I think, from what some of those feminists had been arguing for, as socially constructed. So something that's built on top of a biological body in different ways, in different times, and that can be unbuilt and rebuilt. It's a very simple idea. And this actually was this idea caught on very quickly and became a mantra. So you could go to anywhere where people had been on a gender training course and people say gender is a socially constructed relationship between women and men. It was, you know, said here and there without really much understanding of social constructionism or the relationship between women and men. It was this very kind of pat phrase. And yet this oversimplified what some of the original thinkers from that generation, Annie, Gail Rubin, amongst them, had been saying about gender. And in her landmark piece for the Subordination of Women Conference, Annie talks about the socially constituted nature of gender relations. And she gives an example from Gail Rubin to illustrate her point. She says, what is a domesticated woman? A female of the species? She only becomes a domestic, a wife, a chattel, a playboy bunny, a prostitute, or a human dictaphone in certain relations. Torn from these relationships, she's no more helpmate of man than gold is in itself money. So that's an idea of the social constitution of gender relations. But a lot of the feminist insights, as I'll go on to suggest, from that period ended up diffusing, and the ways in which gender was taken up in development came to revolve around this mantra and the idea that there are these two oppositional categories. One is women, they're hard done by, they're neglected, they're virtuous, and they're universally subordinate to men. And the other is men, who are powerful. So women and men come to be framed by this sex-gender distinction. It's a profoundly heteronormative vision of social and sexual relations. Women are assumed to be heterosexual. They're also assumed to live within conventional kinds of heterosexual relationships, marriages, rather than to be single, non-married, divorced. In fact, all of those women that, during that time in the colonial period, where women were running away and living in all kinds of other kinds of relationships, which carried on, are completely occluded in this model of women being in these particular kinds of relationships and therefore oppressed within them. And gender relations becomes this particular kind of relationship. So it's modelled on a normative heterosexuality. And women within it become oppressed and therefore also objects of development's rescue. So by painting women in these ways, it becomes possible then to think about what might need to be done to save them. So we have gender, the word gender being used in development. There's a lot of worry about what was happening with gender because gender was also about men, but people didn't feel so comfortable talking about men. This is the point where I came into the picture with my work in the early 90s. And a colleague of mine, Nancy Lindisfarne, and I, co-edited this book at a time where there was virtually no feminist writing about masculinities, where colleagues of ours said to us, why are you wasting your time and your energy with this stuff? We've since seen a huge industry in books on men and masculinities, so, and I'm very amazed that that book costs £175. but at that time where gender had been taken up, gender was still very much about women, but the ways in which the gender agenda had started to be articulated was less about these projects of uplift and this, you know, integrating women in development, than in projects which were about trying to train people to get this understanding of gender into their heads on the one hand, and to try to get a more complex appreciation of gender power relationships and the ways in which institutions reproduce those power relationships on the other. So on the one hand, you have quite a sophisticated feminist project. On the other hand, you have the evidence of its implementation, which sometimes isn't so much an understanding of that complicated project and more a kind of taking up of some of its mantras. So gender mainstreaming became the order of the day. And gender equality had been the clarion call of the 90s, and it was taken up and promoted in the Beijing Fourth World Women's Conference in 1995. Women's empowerment, a different term, a different concept, a different idea. Women need power, women need more power. But also women need to work together to disrupt these forms of relationships which undermine them. Women need to come together to break with patriarchy and to bring about more radical changes in their societies. Had been an idea that had come from the global south, was floated around Beijing, as far as I understand it, and had already started to enter into some of the ways that development agencies were talking. And by the early 2000s, women's empowerment was coming up and gender equality had begun to slip away. And some people spoke about Jewe, I don't know if it was ever called Jewe, but anyway, gender equality, women's empowerment, as an acronym. But it's sort of more or less gone by the sort of mid-2000s. And then with the last, I think the death knell in this country was the government deciding that gender was too complicated a word and simple English would be better, and it's better just to talk about women, girls and women. So by the early 2010s, we see this process where gender, too complicated, critique because there's gender mainstreaming and it's failed and it's all become too oversimplified on the other hand, but the feminist project is too radical and people feel too threatened by it because it's all about power. So both of those things are not really getting anywhere. And along comes women's empowerment. And suddenly women's empowerment becomes the way forward. And we see an extraordinary process through which these mainstream big development agencies take up this clarion call of women's empowerment. And you even start to see that in places like Davos, you get people talking about women's empowerment. It's the big thing, it's the next big thing. And it's the weapon against poverty. And so fueling all of that, paradoxically, were a set of gender myths and feminist fables that came out of the work that feminists did and that contributed to development. So they contributed to this gender agenda, but they also contributed a narrative about women, which very quickly began to get taken up by the World Bank and by other powerful agencies. So some of these are, for example, women are less corrupt than men. Women work harder than men. Women are not only less violent, but they want peace more than men. Women are the peacemakers. Women are closer to nature and the earth. Women care more for children than do men. Sex work is the last resort for women who are pushed into it by desperate poverty. And women will take care of their households if they get money rather than spend it on their own pleasure. And that's one of the biggest of the gender myths of all. One which, and I understand myth not to be something that's not true. A myth is something that we like to believe. It's a set of ideas that can help to guide us. And I think what's happened with these gender myths is people have liked to believe them. They've become very fondly believed. And they've had a heavy influence on framing development policy, particularly the idea that women will take care of their children and their households, that they're more reliable than men, they'll spend money better than men, and they're therefore better objects of investment than men. So what we had with the gender agenda, the previous gender agenda, the narrative around which was to do with gender mainstreaming but also with gender power in development, was a very simplified idea about women's power. Women are victims. They're lacking power. And this gives development agencies a sense of moral authority, but it also makes women objects of protection, that somebody needs to look out for women, to look after women. So we see in those narratives, in the narratives around gender, ideas like, for example, the concept of bodily integrity, which becomes a way of protecting women's virtue as well as protecting women's bodies. So when you talk about bodily autonomy, it's a very different sounding thing. When you talk about sexual autonomy, it's a different thing again. Bodily integrity is an idea of protecting these women, and it precludes any recognition of women's sexual agency. It makes women into delicate objects who have to be looked after. And it fits very much again with that continuous thread that goes through from the colonial period of this particular European imaginaries of women. But along with these images of abjection of women and girls as the poorest of poor, abused by men, denied opportunities, in need of empowerment, we also have, and what we have with empowerment and the empowerment discourse, is the heroine. The image of the woman and the girl as an agent of change whose uplift can solve all society's problems. And there's a set of stickers that the Nike Foundation has to accompany its Girl Effect initiative, which says, girls can lift economies, girls can end HIV, girls will lead the revolution. So girls are now becoming the ones who can do everything. They become the magical agents who can make development, all the development's problems be solved. And what happens as a result of the ways in which gender comes to be thought about is that both that it becomes fixed as sexual difference rather than expressing the fluidity and contingency of relationships between gendered identities and sex bodies, but also that anything that fails to fit the frame with these gender myths and feminist fables, anything that doesn't fit with that, is shunted out of the picture. So we can't see men as disempowered. We can't see women as going out and having a bit of a laugh, spending their money on shopping. You know, everything has to be put within this particular vision of these good women who are being created and being empowered by development. And these good women are being created and empowered, and they still lack power. They need to be given power by development. Development allows them to unleash their potential. But what we find is that we don't see men anymore. So the women's empowerment discourse has these women as agents of change, these heroines going out saving the world, lifting economies, ending HIV, doing all these wonderful things. But where are the men? The men have now become a problem because they were also represented as a problem to some degree in the gender discourse. But now the problem is quite concentrated on men as the problem has become concentrated on men in respect of their violence against women and in respect of their sexual behaviour. So where we see work in development on men and masculinity, it's heavily, heavily concentrated in work on sexuality, on sexual violence, and on HIV. There's very, very, very little work, so little that I searched and searched and searched and came up with one study of masculinities in Parliament, for example. So Parliament, you know, we know from feminist writing, very, very male-dominated space, lots of masculinities in Parliament. Wouldn't it be interesting to study it? Well, nobody else seems to think so. There's one study in Australia. So it's not seen as a development issue. And there's only one country where I've ever heard of anything being done about this, by the way, and that's Sweden. But then when you want to find any examples of anything progressive happening in relation to work with men, Sweden often has an example of that. So you see, on the one hand, these men are, they're missing. They're absent from certain areas, certainly around economic empowerment, gender and politics. Economic empowerment, the discourse is very much about, you know, women are more reliable, we need to invest in women, we need to get women into work. Not looking so much at what's happening to lots of young men who might not be able to find work, it might have some effect on their identities and their lives. And men tend to be represented almost in a caricatured way as potentially hazardous and really quite useless. They're violent, they infect women with HIV, they drink away women's money, they don't look after their families, and women are a better investment. Now, I'm caricaturing, but if you read development policy, there is a sense in that that this is the category in which men are now being, or this is the area in which men are now being placed. And this book that colleagues and I did called Politicising Masculinity was saying, look, all these people working in masculinity, we need to go back to some of these core issues around the economy, around politics, and look at masculinity in those arenas. Repoliticize that debate, make it more structural, rather than just see men as a problem who need to be, you know, men need to have nicer behavior, or men need to have the norms changed around the ways in which they navigate their social and sexual relationships. That's very, very important work, but it's not the only work. There's other work to be done as well around some of these other things. So one of the consequences of the ways in which gender and power come to be seen then in development is this, what I think in context where I've worked, is a profound misreading, or the tools with which to misread gender power relations. And this is not something new. You can see it in the work of anthropologists. I found a quote from an anthropologist who influenced me very much in my own field work, Nyara Sudakasa, who did her field work in 1960s southwestern Nigeria. And she writes about the contrast between the literature and what she saw of women's lives. And she says, women were depicted in the literature as saddled with home and domesticity. Men were portrayed as enjoying the exhilaration of life in the outside world. For me, the pictures of the portrait did not ring true. Not only was there an obvious distortion of the ethnographic reality, there was also something inappropriate about the idea that women and men were everywhere related to each other in a hierarchical fashion. And she, writing about a time in which the literature, the feminist literature, was portraying middle-class white women's frustrations with their own, the domesticity that they were being saddled with, has continued with a critique of African feminist writers, of the ways in which women are represented in the development narrative. And a colleague of mine, who former colleague at IDS, Eva Joyce Wynne, wrote about the extent to which women are represented as poor, powerless, and pregnant, the African woman. She said, well, where do I fit with this? What about me? I'm a middle-class African woman. Am I supposed to also fit in with this narrative? So the ways in which the empowerment narrative then has framed these women is just as dissonant with the actual lived reality of women's lives as the victim narrative. And in the empowerment narrative, women are not encumbered by any gender relations. They're simply these agents of change who can be unlocked and sent off to do their thing and to educate a nation, to, you know, be the magic bullet for development. So empowerment has become what a senior DFID bureaucrat described as emment. That's empowerment with the power taken out. And it's a lot of the work that has been done with the gender agenda in development, as it's turned into this stuff about women's empowerment, is to enable individual women to better cope with their circumstances rather than to try to change the power relations that keep other women disempowered. But also the ways in which empowerment and these gender, the relations of gender have been understood in development have meant that all other forms of power fall out of view, and we don't get the complex and rich understanding of power that was part of the original gender agenda, which understood gender very much more as a power relation. So looking back over this period and tracing some of the continuities and the silences, we see a concern with domesticating women. We see from the early colonial period this idea of the women being put to work for development, being good wives and mothers, and then through to the more recent time in which women become the new model citizens as micro-entrepreneurs put to work for development. So what development has done for women might be directed differently at different times, but is very rarely taken into account what women themselves might want to do for themselves. We see the exclusion of women from governance in the colonial and post-colonial period, and women who engaged in anti-colonial struggles were often subjected to community development and training to make them into proper citizens and to stop them being so rebellious. And then we see, more recently, a concern with women's voice, translating not into women actually having more of a voice, but being given seats on relatively ineffective local political institutions. And we see a straight line passing through the whole period about protecting women's virtue into contemporary anti-trafficking and anti-sex work campaigns and rescue projects. So the ways in which gender comes to be framed then in development, we see gender trouble, relations between women, women's resistance, and women's active and positive sexuality falling out of the frame, and as does any woman who doesn't correspond to this narrative of heroine and victim. And within it, we see a profoundly normative set of ideas about gender, this binaries, woman and man, but also the sex-gender binary. And the very idea of any variance in gender is nowhere to be seen. Gender still appears as oppositional categories rather than the plurality of identities and expressions. Trans and intersex people are marginal, invisible, threatening, because they disrupt the gender binary. And yet they're on the rough end of the policing of the gender binary, subjected to discrimination and violence. So to reframe and reclaim and revision the gender agenda, what might we now need to do? Well, I think a lot of the work that I've been involved in has been very critical. It's been criticising development policy. It's been trying to think differently about empowerment. It's been trying to think differently about gender, about men, about a lot of these, about sexuality. And I think trying to think positively about what can be done to reframe or reclaim or reanimate the gender agenda has been very much part of that process of critique. It's been about saying, look, you know, these are the effects that this is having. It's not doing the things that it's sought to do. And let's look again at the ways in which we can start to re-center the concern with power that this began with. And also analyse or look again at the traces that are there from the colonial period, to look at again at the way in which development itself works. So to find a new way of thinking about this, I think we need to really fundamentally reposition power, to go back to thinking more about power in a more sophisticated way. I think development has found that very difficult to do. To reclaim a more structural perspective, but also to make visible the power effects of difference. I think we need to go back to the concept of gender and look at where feminist theory has taken us in terms of gender. And those of you in the room who come from feminist theory, maybe you don't have any idea just how limiting the thinking and development is around gender. It's extraordinary that it's almost been impermeable to a lot of the theoretical insights that come from cultural studies or gender studies. So beyond these limiting binaries, beyond the pervasive heteronormativity that's there in the gender and development discourse. But it also calls for us to think again about what development is. And I think seeing development as planned intervention, which I think that the history of development, beginning from the period in which the British and the French and the other European powers began to put in place laws and institutions and intervene and socially engineer, which gave rise to institutions that then intervened and socially engineered and did projects and programs and so on. It takes us to the obsession with policy and results that we're in right now. I think it takes us away from positive change that makes the world fairer and more pleasurable for everyone, because the nature of that industry itself, it's very difficult for it to produce positive, pleasurable development the way it is right now. I think it's also the need to reimagine what we mean by assistance. We think of development as assistance. What helping might mean, and if helping is hindering, which I think it is quite often. So what's done in the name of development hinders people's own self-development. What can be done about that? So thinking beyond helping people to acts of solidarity and acts of resistance, how to think differently about what development might mean. And I think also to reclaim and to refocus ourselves on that word empowerment. I've been with the word empowerment for quite a while because of this big project, constantly wrestling with it. You know, is it a word that's gone, it's a buzzword that's passed its sell-by date? Is it just got taken up too awfully by the World Bank? Is it something that's worth reclaiming? What does it mean? What does it mean in people's lives? And I've come to it to think of it as something that actually still is a really important word, because it has the word power in it. But also because it's about something that goes beyond what we can do for ourselves. For me, empowerment comes to represent how we can see ourselves, our sense of our own power, our sense of our own imaginations about our own possibilities. And for me, it's as much about expanding our horizons of the possible as it is changing what we can actually do in the world. I think the two things are very deeply connected. But if we can think ourselves, imagine ourselves out of the ways in which we're currently constrained, we can begin to work towards making those things change. And so to end, what I'd like to do is to show two short films. Part of what the project of the Pathways of Women's Empowerment Project has sought to do is to think of the ways in which empowerment gets represented in development and to think beyond some of these limiting representations of women being put to work for development and to look at other ways of thinking about empowerment, other ways of imagining empowerment, but also to produce visual materials that can allow us to think and to hope differently, sometimes by complicating things. And one of the films I'm going to show you is very complicated, what power and empowerment might mean in that. In fact, they're both complicated, but one is particularly complicated because of the context, and you'll get what I mean when you see it. But also by thinking beyond some of the very limiting ways in which empowerment has been thought about in development, where political empowerment, economic empowerment. In fact, actually, it's also about how we feel ourselves to be in our bodies, about the stuff we encounter every day in the street, how we think of ourselves, and about all of those other dimensions of difference, not just about gender, but about race, about sexuality, about all kinds of other dimensions of difference and the power effects of difference. So I'm going to quickly do that, if that's okay.
اوكي ليادة عبيت مرقحتي ام افشار كم زي بكشه
20 شيكل
20 شيكل تودا ربا
انا بلغتي مع زبايني بس باللغه العبريه لاني كل اغلب زبايني يهود عادة كل عملي في داخل المنطقة الإسرائيلية فأنا بلبس مثل ما هم بلبسوا مثل الفتاة تبعتهم المتدينين بلبسوا أنا بلبس مثلهم هم أمان لإلهم أكتر وأمان لإلهم، لأنهم ما بيعطوا الثقة، ما بيأمنوا أن يطلعوا مع واحد يلبس لباس شرعي كامل. كان عربية واليهودية، فأول ما بيطلعوا معي بكون مفاجأة أن امرأة بتعمل تاكسي، أن هم أول ما بفكرون فكرين يهودية. عرضت فكرة شغلة التاكسي على زوجي وعلى أهلي وكذا، كانت صعبة عليهم كتير، كانت صعبة ومستحيل أتكلم في هذا الموضوع، بس ضليت أتكلم فيه وأصريت على هذا الموضوع. ففي الأخير الحمد لله نجحت، وقالوا لي خلص أوكي اعملي في هذا بدك إياه وموفقة، بس تيري باك أمشي على حالك، لأنهم كانوا كتير خايفين علي. أنا بتنقل في بين القدس الغربية والقدس الشرقية بحرية، بتنقل فيها فيش أي حدود بتمنعني بالوصول أو صعوبة بالوصول بين القدس العربية والقدس الغربية. يعني حتى الزباين اليهوديات اللي بتعامل معهم، يعني اللي يهوديات كمان زباين، يعني حتى يوم السبت في أيام العياد بيجوا بتبضعوا هون بالقدس القديمة، بينزلوا على القدس القديمة وبتبضعوا حاجياتهم. حتى اللي بقول لي وين على نص صالون بتروحي، فيوم ما بكون أنت تروح على الصالون خدينا معك يعني، فبيجوا معي على الصالون هون أنا وياهم نيجي مع بعض على الصالون. دائما بيسألوني يعني ما بطلعوا بيعرفوا ان انا عربية من اليهود وهذه، او بس بسألنيها انت مش خايفة؟ ما ايش بدي اخاف؟ عن جد من ايش بخاف؟ بالعكس انا قوية قوية على قد هذا الجدار، ما هو مبني.
Dentro de casa, a minha madracha ficava. Que menina feia, que menina do olhão, que cabelinho, que isso. Elas me maltratavam tanto com o meu valor, com a minha autoestima, que elas não sabiam que elas estavam me fortalecendo. Eu ia no espelho e eu não via isso. Eu via uma mulher guerreira, prestes a vencer na vida. Sou toda negra, sou toda ótima, toda direitinha. Isso incomoda, viu, filha? Essa fortaleza, essa autoestima, às vezes incomoda. Mas eu sim, negra por dentro e por fora. Negra toda boa. Mas tá complicado, porque muitas das mulheres negras que eu conheço têm vontade de ter seu cabelo de trancinha, de tudo, de entrelaço, de mega ré, mas... Aonde trabalha, aonde é professora, a sociedade não aceita. Isso, vamos marcar, então, uma mulher branca e eu no mercado. Assim, a gente pode marcar amanhã, a gente se encontrar no mercado, eu no meu estilo e a mulher branca no estilo normal, o estilo que ela vive. Existe a diferença, sim, no olhar, no pisar. O meu trabalho eu vejo numa forma assim, de reforço, de alicerce, de força. Na nossa cultura negra. Existe a diferença, a beleza negra de Salvador do Leaí. A mulher ela pode ser gorda, tem que ser negra, a altura não importa, mas você vê o Miss Brasil, a mulher tem que ser, tem a estética toda arrumadinha, a carinha boa e uma idade moderada, né? Da política. Tudo é política. A beleza é constada como política. A gente não tem que botar essas coisas na cabeça, a gente tem que viver, porque a gente é como Deus deu o direito e a gente está seguindo aí. E a parte, quando eu comecei a trabalhar com estética, meu intuito era só trabalhar com pessoas negras, porque eu queria que o negro se fortalecesse para ficar igual uma corrente. Mas as coisas se expandiu tanto que hoje é branco, negro, azul, mas o meu valor eu não perco, viu? E não tem nada que me compre. Não tem isso. Faço minha política assim. E meu irmão lindo aqui, cantor. Ave Maria. Esse biquinho de mamãe.
Por que vocês estão fofocando aí sem mim? Vocês estão
fofocando. João Kelly fez meu cabelo.